This episode is brought to you by Skinny Pop Popcorn. Perfectly popped, endlessly delicious. Oh, so light and crunchy. Skinny Pop Original Popcorn is the snack you've been searching for. Made with just 3 simple ingredients, popcorn kernels, sunflower oil, and salt. Snacking never felt or tasted so good. Perfectly popped, endlessly delicious. Give yourself permission to snack and pick up Skinny Pop Original Popcorn today.
I'm Candace Lim, and you're listening to ICYMI. In case you missed it, Slate's podcast about internet culture. And joining me on today's episode is the journalist and writer behind the Substack, Reed Max. It's Max Reed. Hello, Max.
Hi, Candace. How you doing?
I am so good, Max. Welcome to ICYMI. It is your first time here, so I'd love to ask, what's your first internet memory?
I think the honest answer is probably in third or fourth grade. Our teacher had us all gather around the computer, and he signed into CompuServe and showed us CompuServe. And I remember being like, why don't I have this at my home? And we got AOL like a couple years later, I think. But I have this really distinct memory of being in school and watching all the things you could do on CompuServe.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. My third grade teacher, he also was the person who kind of like ushered our class into computers and internets for the first time. I want to be very clear about something, though. The reason he did it was because he wanted us to stream his cousin's album. I'm not even kidding you. Every single day we would go into school and he would be like, hi, guys, we're not going to learn how to type. We're going to stream my cousin's album. And I'm still really pissed about it because I didn't get any residuals from it. I learned nothing. And now he's like the vice principal of a school. I'm sorry, but I helped him succeed.
Wow.
Forget our third grade teachers, because we've moved past that. The internet has moved past that. And today, Max, I have a lot of questions about your Substack and your thoughts on the internet recently. So let's take a break. When we come back, we're diving into Max Reed's internet diaries to ask about his favorite memes, memories, and more right after the break. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
It's always fun to dive into the latest rumors, like who's dating who and who will be on the next season of our favorite show. Well, here's one rumor to squash. The idea that Discover isn't widely accepted. Truth is, Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. That means it's accepted basically anywhere across the country. Don't pay attention to every rumor out there. But remember, it does pay to Discover, based on the February 2024 Nielsen report. Learn more at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, listeners, hope you're enjoying today's show. If this is your first time listening, then welcome. We are thrilled to have you here. In case you missed it, our show comes out twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. So make sure you never miss an episode like this past Wednesday's when we invited some of our favorite friends of the pod to give thanks to the best memes, TikTok trends, and moments we saw online this year. And we're back. I am here with Max Reed, the writer behind your Chronically Online friend's favorite Substack, Reed Max. And today we're diving into Max's internet diaries. Look, Max, you've written about everything from the celebrity NFT economy to how young men on TikTok are shaping politics to this internet. So you've been around the interwebs. I'd like to take it all the way back. Max, what was the first fandom you joined and where did you find them?
So I'm going to date myself here a little bit. The first fandom I joined was the X-Files.
Ooh!
But I don't think we called them fandoms back then. And I don't remember there being quite as aggressive a culture around it. It was a culture of fanfic, obviously, and sort of endless nitpicking and theorizing online that you could dig up on GeoCities pages and message boards and various other places. And it was, to be clear, like a fandom in all but name. And I'm sure there were somewhat more sophisticated people who were very clear about that. But a huge portion of my early internet activity was spent trying to figure out what was going on in all the X-Files episodes I hadn't seen and trying to piece together the conspiracy behind all of it.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, you have dropped a key word, which is fan fiction, Max. Be honest, did you read or write fan fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I read tons of X-Files fan fiction. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because the way I remember thinking about it was there's only one episode a week, but you want to spend all your time investigating aliens with Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
So what can you do but read, especially once you've read through all the paperback tie-ins and everything else, you got to hop on. I don't even remember what the actual website was where I was finding most of it. I can't say, you know, I sort of wish that I was bold enough to have written some myself, but I certainly was consuming a lot of it.
This is good to get out there. Do you still at all dabble in like seeing an X-Files fan edit here and there? Do you ever still kind of like dip your toe just to check in, just to check in?
No, I mean, I spent about 20 years away from the show, and then I came back and I started rewatching it recently. And I mean, obviously, it's a great show. It's so fun to watch. It's so fun to they don't make stuff like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Like the sort of 24 episodes, every single one is pretty good. But you know, I it was nice just to be back watching the show. I wasn't yet ready for the for a new generation of fan edits and fan fiction.
Not yet. Not yet until after this episode when you pop open CapCut, when you pop open iMovie, and you're just uploading anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I'm sure. I mean, I can only imagine the way people talk about assistant director Skinner these days.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Max, I'd love to know, what does a typical day on the internet look like for you? So, like, what are you checking when you wake up? What are the things you're looking at before you go to sleep? Talk me through it.
Yeah. So I have made an effort to remove social media from my phone. Wow. So when I wake up, I will pull up my phone and I will open my browser and enter in Twitter and look at Twitter because I have deleted the app from my phone. But I am still embarrassingly checking Twitter basically first thing, especially these days, like the bulk of my Twitter reading is sports related, really.
Sure.
So if especially like during the baseball season or the day after a football game or something, I will be spending a lot of time consuming either like stuff that makes me want to die because my team lost or just exulting in my team's win.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a couple like Discords and like friend Slacks, and they tend to be active overnight. So like these are like private or private-ish spaces that I spend time checking, you know, sort of catching up on. We're still, just to like clarify the setting, in bed before my son has gotten up, often before my wife has gotten up, just trying to get my fill of, you know, scrolling bullshit before I actually have to face the world. You know, if it counts as internet, I'll do a Times crossword or Wordle or whatever, depending on how much time I have. And then once I've done all that, I can fully get up and I can make breakfast and I can take my kid to school. And then I have to sit at my computer and do basically the exact same thing. Got to check Twitter. You know, Blue Sky recently has gotten a lot more populated. There's a lot more stuff going on there. I'll check Blue Sky. I will just drop as many links as I can into the group chats because you've got to hope that you can start a conversation that will distract you from starting work. Like the worst thing in the world is there's no notifications. Nobody's talking to you. And you actually have to like confront the work you have to do.
Yeah.
I don't really have an RSS reader anymore. I used to read tons and tons in Google Reader. And then I used a website called Feedly for a while after that. But so many blogs and so many websites that used RSS as their main publishing mechanism have moved to newsletters. So I do spend a ton of time going through my email inbox, reading the newsletters I get, archiving the ones that I get that I don't ever actually read. I check my Letterboxd a lot, especially if I've just reviewed a movie. I have to get the dopamine hit of the likes and the follows on the Letterboxd review. And I think that's kind of it. You know, it's like I do feel like as I get older, my website diet has narrowed a little bit. It's the same, you know, six or seven spots that I'm cycling through, just looking for stuff to do, which is a function, I think, both of like the way the internet is these days, and also just a function of having a pretty clear sense of like what I'm looking for and what I want out of it. You know, I'm not like a big YouTube guy. I'm not a big TikTok guy. Like I'm just too old for video to be like a good way for me to consume things. I'm still like majority text is like how I go about things. But yeah, you know, it's like just continuously looking at Discord, Slack, Twitter, Blue Sky, Letterboxd, iMessage, Discord, Slack, Twitter, Blue Sky, Letterboxd, iMessage. I think everybody who listens is familiar with that kind of cycle.
Mm-hmm. Wow, there is a lot of meat to talk about in the sandwich. I'll start here. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do.
Okay.
Though my podcasts are like my taking a walk time, my dish washing the dishes thing, my like going on a run thing. Mm-hmm. Like I think of it as somehow separate from internet time, even though they are obviously from the internet and come from the internet.
Interesting. Do you want to drop some names of like fave pods that you like right now?
Sure, yeah. I mean, my absolute favorite podcast is one that I can't in good conscience recommend. It's called Hollywood Handbook. And it's a comedy podcast that you have to listen to like 15 to 20 of them before it starts to get mm-hmm. funny. And then once you've done that, it's really funny. It's so funny. Let's see. I have this bad, you know, habit of trying to maximize my time. So Hollywood Handbook is like completely useless, almost certainly removes brain cells from my brain. But for the most part, I try to listen to things that I think will make me smarter. So like my favorite is the BBC show and podcast In Our Time, which is the host interviews three academics about a topic, like a hugely wide range of topics from history to literature to science, to biology, to geology. And there's a new episode every week and it's like 30 minutes and I always feel like I learn a lot. I really like the London Review of Books podcast, which is often just interviews with authors of pieces in that issue, many of which are sort of historical or political, sort of really interesting. Like the one I was just listening to in the car the other day was about numeracy in early modern Britain and how people became aware of how to count and use figures and use numbers. I learned, for example, that before, you know, the 17th century, the 18th century, that numbers were sort of the domain of like craftspeople and artisans, like carpenters used numbers, but like professors wouldn't use numbers. It wasn't really a thing they did. I do listen to a lot of sports podcasts. I've recently become like a huge, like a lot of men in their 30s in Brooklyn, a huge English Premier League fan, a soccer fan. I listen to a lot of podcasts about Tottenham Hotspur, which is my favorite team. I've really not been listening to podcasts recently because the political news has really been depressing me too much. So like the history podcast, I'm talking about the history podcast a lot because it's so great to just have something you can like turn on. And it's like, no, this isn't about Tottenham losing to Ipswich. And no, it's not about everything that's happened in US politics in the last 3 to 4 months. It's just about numeracy in early modern Britain.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about your work a bit because before Substack, you worked at Gawker, a very beloved site from 2010 to 2015. At one point, you were their editor-in-chief. And I read this article from Brooklyn Magazine that described your pieces there as, quote, "This thing is bad, and if you disagree with me, you're dumb posts." Okay, first off, do you agree with this?
I think, yes, but I wouldn't. I think there were posts like that. I regret those posts, but yes, I do think I posted like that often.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I now want to ask, what is your memory of working at Gawker? Because I sometimes feel like ex-staffers talk about Gawker 1.0 the way like ex-BuzzFeeders talk about working at BuzzFeed, how it was like the height of internet journalism. It was the millennial dream job. And then all of a sudden it came crashing down and they look back at it with very different prescription lenses, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the short answer is I feel ambivalent about my time there. I mean, I really loved the people I worked with. I mean, that's the thing, as is often the case in like first jobs, or because it was effectively my first job, or really intense jobs, which Gawker was, you make really close friendships that have lasted me since then. And I feel like I was challenged in ways that I still sort of hold to have been really important to me. It was, as you said, like a time of a lot of excitement in digital media. Like there really was a sense, especially, so I started, as you said, in 2010. Gawker had been around at that point for 7-ish years. Mm-hmm. And it sort of expanded from like what was originally a very small, single person, mostly media focused gossip blog to like a pretty broad tabloid news blog, humorous tabloid news blog, I guess. And you know, we were bringing in millions of readers every month. I mean, we were like we were hitting page view numbers that like I have never recreated in my life since. There was a sense that we were doing important work. I mean, and I use the word important advisedly. Like a lot of what we were doing was like reblogging weird crime stories and sort of like, you know, unpacking juicy gossip. But we were reaching big audiences. We did genuine investigative journalism alongside the fun stuff. And it was hard not to be really confident about the website and about the state of the industry and sort of what we were doing and how we were doing it. In retrospect, that was like wholly misplaced confidence. I mean, I think it's important to note that like Gawker was destroyed from the outside. Not there's like 40 websites I could name from like circa 2011 that are no longer with us, but not like Vice or not like even like BuzzFeed, which is sort of nowhere near the kind of size or influence it was. That Gawker, like Peter Thiel hated Gawker and funded a lawsuit against it that ultimately bankrupted the company. And I'm so fascinated at the sort of counter history, like how Gawker might have survived had that not happened. But either way, I mean, it's become clear to me over the last few years that the sort of insurgent energy of those blogs, many of which were like really well funded by venture capital investment, has disappeared. And in fact, like the mainstream media that we all sort of thought we might replace, like the New York Times in particular, has co-opted a lot of the strategies and even in fact the journalists who do it. So like it's hard not to look back on that and think, damn, like you were pretty stupid for thinking that that this was going to last forever. And you know, as is sort of pretty well documented, it was not actually a particularly healthy workplace. But you know, like a lot of millennials in their 20s, I was like really eager to impress people and like work really hard and show off a lot. And so that, you know, it's like if I wasn't doing it there, I probably wouldn't be doing it somewhere else. You know, I think the thing I like to sort of keep close to my chest is like, for a little while, at least in the Trump administration, I feel like there was a kind of meme, this like sense that, oh, if Gawker was still around, they would have been uncovering all of these like nasty Trump stories that other people are too afraid to go after. And that may or may not be true, but my main memories of Gawker were being like extremely funny and weird and interesting and lively, not less the sort of like journalism that we use to like defend ourselves, and a lot more the kind of ability to write with a really strong voice to a huge audience with not much else going on, but sort of confidence and willingness to put yourself out there, which I think are skills that I have taken with me like everywhere I've gone since.
Can I ask, do you remember any of the posts that you regret writing?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I left Gawker as I was editor-in-chief and we published a post. And I'm not going to get into this too much, mostly because I have relitigated this endlessly in my own head and with other people. But we published a post that outed a media executive as having gone to a sex worker in Chicago.
And the piece you're talking about is when Gawker put out a piece in 2008 outing Apple CEO Tim Cook as gay.
Yeah, it was mishandled. I mean, there's like a million excuses I could make. Like the buck stopped with me. I was the editor. Shouldn't have posted it. Unquestionably regret that because it sort of blew up a job and a set of relationships I had that were really important to me. But like when I really look back on it, like that post was a product of a culture, like a particular kind of culture at Gawker, an editorial culture, a work culture. And it's the stuff that I really regret that I think gets a lot less attention. We wrote a lot of stuff. I mean, I was sort of joking about weird crime, reblogging weird crime stories, but like a stock and trade, not just for us, but for Huffington Post and really anybody doing this kind of high volume blogging work, were these stories about like people who were in retrospect in like very obvious places of distress getting arrested for like a story. I remember a guy high on meth was arrested for breaking into a house and cleaning the house, which is like objectively funny, except that the thing about reporting on it is like you're putting the guy's mugshot and full name in a searchable place on the internet where it's going to haunt him forever. And if he ever gets clean and wants to get a job and wants to figure his life out, like these results are going to be chasing him around forever. And I used to get, even after I left, emails from people who were in exactly that position. You know, some a Fish fan who was arrested for getting naked at a concert or whatever, who we'd written about. And, you know, my policy at Gawker was always to de-index this stuff, like just not delete it, because that would open up a certain kinds of like legal problems, or at least that was what I was told, but to de-index it so that Google couldn't find it anymore. But once I left Gawker, I didn't have access to that. And there was very little I could do besides asking the future owners to take that stuff down. Long story short, Gawker as a website barely exists now. The archives of Gawker now exist on a website at the address gawkerarchives.com. The Google search functionality is like completely broken. So that problem has kind of been solved at the expense of like ever checking Gawker archives. But I think that was like, for me, the real sort of victims of Gawker were less the like richer and more powerful people whose business was exposed by the site, but like people who really didn't have a choice, who got arrested, you know, in unfortunate ways, and who not just Gawker, but hundreds of websites suddenly made their name forever attached to this particular unfortunate incident across the internet.
Yeah, I think a lot of writers and journalists, absolutely. You ask that question of like, is there anything that you even regret doing, saying, writing, emailing, and like something pops up. And what's interesting about the internet is like, we were kind of taught that the internet never forgets. But at the same time, we are speaking in the year that things like MTV News is gone, Gawker 2.0 is off the shelves, and there are so many pieces of great work that go by the wayside in an attempt to forget, which is kind of interesting. But yeah. I do kind of want to talk a little bit about your work now, because at some point, you leave the industry and you become a Substacker. So I wanted to ask, what has it been like transitioning from being a journalist for a publication to writing and owning your Substack? Like, is there anything on either side that you really, really prefer, or anything you really, really miss?
That's a great question. One of the interesting things about having had my start at Gawker and having learned like most of my trade there is that I've always had to be, just by virtue of how that job and how often blogging jobs in general work, I've always had to be a pretty entrepreneurial writer, by which I mean like spend a lot of time coming up with my own stories, packaging my own stories, promoting my own stories. I spent 5 years in New York Magazine in between Gawker and Substack, and that was the sort of most, the biggest publication I've ever worked for, mm-hmm. like both in terms of like actual size of the institution and also sort of its prominence. And there was somewhat more sort of oversight and support and all these things. But one thing that has allowed New York Magazine to transition so successfully from being a, you know, weekly print magazine to being a sort of multi-vertical website empire plus magazine is adopting the kind of principle of like letting smart young writers like figure out, use their voices and figure that stuff out themselves sort of on the page with the support and supervision of editors, which is all a long way of saying that like, I don't know that there's a huge amount of difference between what I do at Substack and what I was doing before, except that there's like absolutely no safety net. Instead of the possibility of like an editor being able to help me put something up or being able to talk a story over with somebody, it's really just me and me alone. But because I'm so used to, you know, my first job at Gawker was doing the overnight shift. So from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m., I would just be by myself updating the site. I have a familiarity with how to like handle working by yourself, putting your own ideas out there. And I suppose I kind of like it. You know, I have friends who work at more conservative institutions like the Times or whatever. And I always feel like I would feel a bit restrained, you know, that once you are used to being able to come up with an idea, type it out and publish it without anybody or anything standing in the way, it becomes really hard to give that up. And Substack, to the extent that it's basically just a blog, allows me to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. I guess using a sports metaphor, we are two teams in the same league, the league being internet culture coverage. And I wanted to ask, as someone who covers the internet, do you feel like it is easy for you to separate something that could become a post, something that could be work, something you talk about, versus something you look at just for fun and enjoy?
That's a good question. I mean, no, not easy.
Yeah.
It's like the core question of what we do, kind of, right? It's like when your job is your life and your life is your job, it's like really hard to see. I mean, I try to set boundaries around writing about my personal life and people in my life. So I don't write about my kid a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't write about my wife, really. I try to like keep my personal stuff out of it, which I know is sort of anathema to like what we understand to be successful online. But I think that drawing those hard boundaries allows me to feel a little bit more comfortable being like, anything else I see on the internet, that can be a post. Like I can't, it doesn't have to be 1600 words. It doesn't even have to have like an argument. It can just be an observation. And the trick to me is like finding the ways to package that stuff. It's like I think part of the thing you're asking about is not just like, you know, the life work boundaries. It's also like so much of what you see online is like ephemeral, and maybe not even actually that interesting, but it catches your eye for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, well, is this worth devoting 6 hours or whatever to like putting something together?
Yeah.
And like the answer to that question is sort of, you know, it depends always. But I think that one thing I do feel like I learned at Gawker was that, you know, you don't have to make a fetish of like action energy. Like you can sometimes stuff is just a 2-sentence post or a 2-paragraph post. It doesn't have to be much more than that or much less than that. We had a rule, or really Deadspin, the sports site that was attached to Gawker, had a rule called the Slack rule, which is that if somebody dropped a link into Slack and 6 people commented on it, that was like, that's a post. If 6 people have a reaction to this one thing, it needs to go on the website. Stop messing around, stop chatting, just put it on the website. And I try to keep that voice in my head, because more often than not, it's like, I mean, to take an example, you referenced like the Zinternet earlier. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a piece this summer about sort of a new, what I saw as a sort of emerging internet culture of like frat boys who love to gamble on sports and love college football and are like sort of conservative and really love Zyn, the pouch nicotine product. Mm-hmm. And I called it the Zinternet. And this was like just a thing that I sort of thought of. It didn't have a clear argument in my head, didn't know what it was gonna say or whatever. But I was sort of like, this phrase is stuck in my head, this idea, this thing I've observed. I think I just need to like pound something out and see what happens. And this piece turned out to be like really successful. Like clearly I had struck a nerve, and I feel like there's that kind of reducing the sort of fear or whatever. Fear is maybe not quite the word, but reducing that sort of like, is this a post? Is this not a post? Everything's a post has helped me kind of like get as much stuff out as possible.
Yeah. I have so many more questions to ask you about how you just like handle living in this economy on the internet. So let's take a break. When we come back, I'll ask Max about his golden rules for being online. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. There's joy in finding the perfect gift for the ones you love, but it can be a challenge. Saks.com's holiday gift guide makes it easy. Whether you're surprising your hard-to-shop-for sister with a Chloe bracelet bag or gifting your partner a memorable scent from Gucci, at Saks.com, there's holiday inspiration for every personality on your list. I love using Saks.com because it is clean, easy to use, and so fun to scroll around for inspiration. I'm currently on the hunt for a really nice winter coat, and I'm also looking to put together some fun holiday looks, especially with all these Christmas parties coming around the corner. Now, thankfully, Saks has me covered because they have everything my friends have been begging me for, from Le Labo candles to Jo Malone London perfumes. And while I'm there, I might as well throw in these really cute Michael Kors boots I've been dying to gift myself. Saks.com's hand-picked guide can help take the stress out of the holidays. Add instant cheer to your home with some bright decor. Find gifts guaranteed to bring joy to everyone this holiday season at Saks.com. That's Saks.com for the ultimate holiday gift guide and all the shopping inspiration you need. It's always fun to dive into the latest rumors, like who's dating who and who will be on the next season of our favorite show. Well, here's one rumor to squash: the idea that Discover isn't widely accepted. Truth is, Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. That means it's accepted basically anywhere across the country. Don't pay attention to every rumor out there. But remember, it does pay to Discover, based on the February 2024 Nielsen report. Learn more at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game, shifting a little money here, a little there, just hoping it all works out? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can be a better budgeter and potentially lower your insurance bill too. You tell Progressive what you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll help you find options within your budget. Try it today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
And we're back. So Max, I actually wanted to talk to you about something you just referenced before the break, which is the Zinternet. I will be honest, please don't shoot the messenger. This is kind of how I first heard about you. The Zinternet, we did an episode about it. I talked about it with Luke Winkie, another staffer at Slate. This is an interesting moment. You kind of came up with this term Zinternet. And I first off want to ask, like, did you think anyone would care about it?
I thought I was writing about something that was real, right? And every time you write about something that you did, like, Lord knows I've written about a lot of stuff that's effectively made up. When you're writing about internet culture, you're constantly writing about stuff that is kind of real and not really real, and you never expect it. But I knew that there was this thing going on, this thing that I'd noticed, the thing that, like, people around me had noticed. And I knew that the giving it a name and a description was a sort of useful service. But what I didn't quite realize is, like, how many other people were seeing it. I mean, this is a case of, like, internet silos where I was talking to other, like, 30-something dads who are consuming, I mean, I can't believe how much we're talking about sports content, which it doesn't actually feel like it's a huge portion of my media diet, but the number of times I talk about sports must mean that it is.
Yeah.
But, like, if you're watching sports highlights on Instagram, and if, like, looking at sports tweets, you're a lot more likely to get served a lot more of, like, internet stuff on Twitter and Instagram. So for me, this is always like, this is a piece for the people who are in that same position. But clearly, like, what surprised me was realizing that a lot of people had sort of recognized this same trend, this same kind of, like, shifting of internet culture things. And so that, I mean, it was heartening. It's, like, nice to know, like, I would have tried harder if I had known, you know, I would have spent a little more time on the piece if I had known how much it would connect.
I feel like the reason your piece kind of hit is because all of us, like, internet culture people, we were like sharks circling this idea. We knew something was there. We smelled it. We didn't know what it was. And I think by you naming it and defining it, it was like dropping a piece of filet mignon in the ocean. And all of us just kind of be like, finally, there's meat to talk about. I want to ask, have you gotten any backlash for that post, though?
Not really. I mean, first of all, I think that, like, real deep, like, Zinternet, the people who occupy the Zinternet have not read it. Like, it's a Substack post by a 38-year-old, you know, who worked at Gawker a long time ago. But I also think, like, I wouldn't just say it was a non-judgmental post, but it was judgmental in a way. When I write about subcultures like that, I think what people who belong to subcultures want more than anything is the sense that they're, like, being seen and recognized. And that's not quite the same thing as being, like, complimentary, that you can be, you know, a little bit mean and a little bit snarky, provided that you demonstrate, like, fluency in the, like, actual sort of objects of the subculture. And I think the Zinternet thing, like, one of the things that made it work, and another reason that people weren't, like, mad at me about it, was that I knew enough about it to be able to say the right call for name and, like, to understand who the actual people were, that it wasn't just a kind of vague, like, oh, these are just, like, frat guys on the internet, that, like, that kind of specificity is really valuable for any reader, but also for the people who you're covering, because then at least they know that, like, you're not coming from this from, like, a completely outsider perspective where you don't know or give a shit. You have some sense of, like, what is actually going on there and what it is.
Yeah, Max, I think that there is still so much to ask. I want to know more about the person behind this internet. So I think we should do a rapid fire round of questions to complete your internet diary. How do you feel about this?
I'm ready.
Okay, cool. I'm going to ask you a question. Give me, like, one or two sentences, anything that comes to your mind. Here we go.
Okay.
Number one, what is the meme you referenced the most?
Oh, God, this is really hard. I mean, maybe this is revealing, like, I'm not a memes guy anymore. Like, I can't think of the last meme I referenced. It's real, like, you reach 39 and just sort of, like, I'm sending more emojis than I ever used to. Like, I really am becoming my parents. Like, I'm doing way fewer gifts and way more emojis these days.
Interesting. Okay, bonus question. Favorite emoji?
This salute. I love this salute.
Ooh.
I'm huge. I'm all in on the salute. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. All right.
Still.
Next. What is your most deeply held but least provable internet conspiracy theory?
Oh, this is a good one. I shouldn't say this because I recently wrote a piece where I said I don't believe it, but I do effectively believe in dead internet theory. Like, I do think it's basically, like, even if it's not true in every particular, I think it's effectively true that 90% of what you encounter on most social media platforms is bot derived in one way or another.
Okay, can you explain this? I don't think I've heard this phrase before.
So dead internet theory is the idea that most of what you find online is not actually made by humans, that there are in fact not all that many humans online, that it's mostly bots. The, like, the fullness of the theory is usually it's like it's a government, you know, psyop for, like, turning people into sheep or whatever. I don't think it's quite true. And I will say, like, what's funny about it to me is, like, somebody's got to make the bots. So there's actually, like, what I think is there is a dead internet theory, but there's also, like, a whole army of, like, basically of guys around the world who are just making bots to sell money. You can read more about this in my New York Magazine piece on AI slop. But the basic concept that there's like more bot generated, more AI generated, more algorithmically oriented stuff online than there is stuff that like humans actually want to create or consume, I think is absolutely true. And it's like that I fully buy.
Max, I hope you hop off this call and open Final Draft, because could this not be a fantastic sequel to The Beekeeper? The Beekeeper 2, The Hive Was Never Real. Ooh.
Wow.
Starring Channing Tatum. Ooh. It's actually a dance musical. Anyway. Max, I would love to know, what are your personal rules for engaging online? For example, how do you know who to fight and like who to ignore?
I mean, my rule is simply do not engage. I am too old for this shit. I used to fight all the time online. I have never felt in retrospect like I changed anyone's mind, like I spent, it was a good use of my energy, or like it was worthwhile, except insofar as it made more people follow me. And so I had a nice platform to start with on the Substack. So, you know, like if you have to pick a fight, I think the number one rule is just the internet. Number one rule is you cannot appear mad. Like the worst thing you can do is seem mad. The worst thing you can do is say I'm not mad. The worst thing you can do is is suggest that you actually think something is funny.
Yeah.
You have to like achieve the full Zen state of actually not being mad. Otherwise, everybody can tell that you are mad and you automatically lose the fight.
Oh, God. I'm laughing because I've been having this weird fantasy lately where like, thankfully, our listeners are great people who don't like put negativity into the world. But sometimes I like worry for the day when someone like writes a tweet about me, like something I've said on the pod. And I've already decided that I'm going to respond and just write all lower caps LOL, because I think it would actually kind of terrify them of like, what is she laughing at me? Is she laughing at it? Is she laughing at herself and is actually willing to humor that contingency? And I love it.
The single LOL is like a great response.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay. Next. What is something that you feel like most internet or culture coverage is missing?
I mean, it's funny. We were just talking about this internet. I think that there is internet culture writers, myself included, get really enamored with and taken up with stuff that is sort of visibly subcultural in the real world and the way it manifests itself online, because it tends to be the case that, I know I'm going way past quick response here, that like subcultural stuff is oversampled online because you go online because you belong to a subculture and that's how you connect. But I think it often means that you like miss the kind of basic normie use and understanding of the internet. Like people like, for example, Zinternet members who are like, you know, part of it, of the offline dominant culture, how they engage with and interact online, you know. And part of the reason for that is like, it's kind of boring to just be like, people who are normal and have normal jobs just do normal stuff online. But I think it also means that it's easy to get a little bit too sort of carried away with thinking about the internet as reflective of the real world in some sense, when in fact, like what makes the internet so engaging and captivating and interesting is that it's not reflective of the real world, that it's more fun in a lot of ways, that there are more smart people on it, there's more interesting stuff going on. So keeping in mind that like the way we use the internet is so unbelievably different from the way most people do, and the things that we consume and produce on the internet are for a much smaller audience than we really imagine. Therefore, even as big as it sounds when you talk about the like the numbers that we're talking about, is like just a useful kind of reality check when you're thinking about the, let's say, the interplay between online and offline culture.
And last question for the episode, what gives you hope about the internet? Like, what do you think the next generation after us is doing a good job of?
I'm in a medium hopeful place right now. I don't feel quite as depressed as I was recently about like the future of the internet. I am encouraged by like how little I understand about Zoomers and how Zoomers use the internet and what they're doing online and what things they find funny. Like, I think it would be much more depressing if I was able to recognize and understand like their senses of humor and their references and stuff. So, you know, I think the internet has always been and will continue to be, kind of has to be, powered by youth culture the same way all kinds of culture have to be. So to the extent that like people younger than me are able to dominate and push their own videos, memes, ideas, jokes, stuff that I find at best baffling and at worst kind of like awful to think about and look at, is probably, ironically, counterintuitively, a hopeful sign.
Yeah. Max, we've completed your internet diaries. I guess before we close out, I'd love to know, if you were to institute one rule that everyone on the internet had to follow, what would it be?
I mean, I think we should all follow a version of Slack rule that anything that you drop in more than, say, 3 group chats, you have to put online in public for everybody to see.
I like that. I like that.
More dirty laundry, please. More gossip, more embarrassing stories.
Become the content you wish to see in the world, because you are an influencer, right, Max? So you're always right. You're always right.
Exactly.
Okay, that's the show. I want to thank Max Reed for joining me on today's episode. You can find his newsletter at maxreed.substack.com. We'll be back in your feed on Wednesday, so definitely subscribe. That way, you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review in Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com. ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks and me, Candace Lim, with production assistance from Alexander Boti and Kat Hong. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. See you online or off the Zinternet.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.